le château. Okay, I think we're going to make a start. Can you all hear me? If I just speak like this, is that fine? Can you hear me? If I speak like this, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
Are they recording this?
Apparently, yeah. Yeah. Hello, I'm Paul Johansson. Hi. I'm just thinking about my credentials, I don't know. I'm a social worker by trade, I'm a psychotherapist. I call myself at the moment a relational skills trainer because I do quite a lot of work in communication skills and mindful self-compassion, which comes under what I think that something which we could call relational intelligence. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that. The first thing I'm going to say is about the space, because it was when I came in here, it was like a theatre sort of thing. So that meant I was up here and I was kind of lecturing. And what I really wanted this session to be much more about was something a little bit more kind of interactive. And we are going to be doing some thinking together, some kind of pairs work. I had an idea that we might do a whole group discussion, but I don't know whether that's actually going to be possible. But one of the things I would offer as to start off with is that when you're thinking about creating a safe space, I think one of the best things to think about is about a circle without any tables. And we can't do that today, so that's really unfortunate, but I tried to do the best by making a kind of a sort of horseshoe. I think the other thing I want to say at the start is, I think sometimes when we slow down and start thinking about ourselves and our own needs, that can act as a trigger for some people. It can be quite difficult, I think, sometimes. It can produce what Chris Germer, who's a psychotherapist and formulated something called mindful self-compassion, which we're going to be having a go at later. He talks about it as the backdraft effect. The backdraft effect, which is it's like a It's from a firefighting term. I think when there's been a backdraft effect. Yeah,
okay.
It's in a fire when you have fire surrounding everywhere and there's a little space which is kind of which is clear and has been clear. When you open that space up, the fire will rush in. Okay. So this is the thing about stopping and actually looking inward. Sometimes that can actually produce this kind of very, very strong reaction. It may not. But what I was just going to say to people is this short time we have together really is about looking after yourself. So if you're finding it, for whatever reason, too difficult, then please do the self-caring thing. Take yourself away. Tune me out. Think about a holiday or something like that. Really do what you need to. So, compassion. I think sometimes it's either seen as something kind of incredibly heroic, the sort of compassionate hero who sort of goes the extra mile, you know, and at the expense of themselves. And I think that's a kind of a meme, an idea, which is very, very present in our culture, but I think specifically in our health and social care culture. Or it's kind of relegated as something soft and pink and fluffy. Something that's kind of extraneous to need, that is not to do with the task, and we've got to get on with the task. There's a kind of very polarised views of compassion. And I think I want to introduce it as something which is not only kind of immense central, but is also something which is far more kind of practical, and, as I say, I'm calling it relational intelligence, so it's something which can be cultivated and learned and attended to. So that's kind of the theme that I want to talk about. And I want to offer you some ideas and offer you some practices and some ways forward. And it's only going to be a taster. So it's going to be kind of a rapid sort of express ride through some of this territory. And what I would say is that if you have a question, please pipe up and ask, and we can have some kind of discussion. That would be really great. Thank you. Okay. So, I was the extra mile. I don't know if people have heard this, but when Jesus said these words in Palestine at the time, the extra mile was referring to, there's a guy called Walter Fink, he's a theologian who talks about this, it's referring to the practice that a Roman centurion could actually stop a local and get them to carry their pack, which is about a sort of a 50-pound pack, a really considerable pack, for a mile. But only 1 mile, okay? Anything else was actually against military law. So Walter Fink says that actually offering to carry the pack an extra mile was a kind of a form of non-violent resistance. It was actually putting the centurion into a position where he'd actually be breaking military law. Okay, so it's actually quite provocative. It's not this kind of sort of martyred sort of, I'm going to do this at the expense of myself. It's actually doing something about changing the relationship between the victim and the oppressor. And I just would like to offer that as a kind of a way of, you know, I'm going to invite you to be open and curious about a lot of the stuff I'm going to be talking about in that sort of a way, about thinking about your relationship to yourselves and others, okay? And thinking about changing that perhaps. I love that because it's so against what we kind of, the extra mile, and particularly in the NHS, if they go the extra mile, if they knew it was about non-violent resistance, I think they might stop sounding. Okay, so compassion is, and this is from Professor Paul Gilbert, which I'm sure some of you have heard of, the Compassionate Mind Foundation. Behaviour that aims to nurture, look after, teach, guide, mentor, soothe, protect, offer feelings of acceptance and belonging in order to benefit another person. It's a nice definition. I don't think it's necessarily complete. I think there's other things we could say about it, but I think I really like that because it's this sense of behaviour and it's a sense of acting. You know, there's a real sense of action. I think that this is something that's really important, crucial, really. It is not sentimentality. And I think compassion gets so often reduced to sentimentality. Carl Jung, the famous psychoanalyst, talked about how sentimentality can reside next to extreme aggression. And he was really thinking about the Nazis when he said this. And I think you can actually see how sometimes our sentimental view of compassion and the heroic, compassionate hero can reside alongside some real aggression there are to some portions of our society. So it's not sentimentality, it's not pity, it's not indulgence, and it's not excusing bad behaviour. And I want to say something else a little bit, but it's also not empathy. And there's a paper by Zilmecki et al, if you care to read it, it's a neuroscience paper, which actually looked at brain plasticity amongst cohorts of people who were trained in empathic resonance and trained in compassion. Okay. And what they discovered was that empathic resonance, just that kind of feeling of like, oh, that's awful. Okay, people who were actually kind of trained in a sense to do that was highly correlated with burnout, whereas taking it a step further and saying, ow, that hurts, and then sending kindness, very simple kind of practice of compassion, was highly correlated with resilience. So I think that this is a really important thing to understand, and I think possibly goes some way to explaining some of the burnout that we get amongst our population of helpers, who probably have a lot of empathic resonance, but unfortunately not trained in those kind of basic practices about warmth and compassion, which are actually very simple to learn.
Do you think that people can learn?
Yes. Yes, we're going to do some. We're going to do a little bit of that.
I don't think some people are naturally compassionate people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I can really see how it's possible to think that, definitely. My father-in-law said that to me. He says, you're not very compassionate. And I said, that's why I do this. That's why I do this practice. It's because I'm not very compassionate and I need to practice it. So I'll hold that thought and we'll see at the end, maybe. I think it's a really important thing. And actually, it's actually central to a lot of what I'm going to say. So, relational intelligence. This is an idea from a guy called Steve Potter and Judy Lloyd, who are cognitive analytic therapists, which is the sort of therapy that I practice. This idea of relational intelligence, which is something which is operational within ourselves, so self to self, so being relating intelligent to oneself, but also relating intelligently to others at a societal level, at a kind of a communal tribal level, emotional and executive. Executive is kind of the doing stuff. And you can actually kind of detail the different sorts of ways of practicing relational intelligence at each of these levels. I can't go into it much more now, but just to offer you as that kind of way of thinking about compassion as a form of relational intelligence. Okay. A way of relating. So, self to self, self to other, other to self. Paul Gilbert talks about this as the way of the flow of compassion, flow of compassion from self to self, flow of compassion from self to other, and from other to self. And crucially, thinking about this relational intelligence and the way we relate, it obviously very conscious ways, like I'm sitting here now relating to you, but there's also going to be lots of kind of unconscious stuff going on of which I'm not aware, which maybe you might be able to see, rather embarrassingly, but you might be able to see my kind of little peccadilloes and things like that, which I'm actually not aware of. Or when you're in a very close relationship with somebody, maybe a helping relationship, sometimes the ways in which you're interacting with them, you're not fully aware of. And this is really quite crucial, because part of relational intelligence is about really looking at those things and actually maybe bringing some of the less conscious aspects to the surface. Okay, so three habits of relational intelligence. We're going to do some work in pairs now. These are not the only three habits of relational intelligence. Asking questions that matter. And everybody who's done any research knows that finding the right research question is absolutely essential. But when we're actually sort of making any sort of inquiry, finding a question that really matters to you and really matters to the situation is really, really important. Listening with a quiet mind. Actually, should we just have a go at putting our feet on the floor now, putting your pens down? Just put both your feet on the floor. Feeling that, if you just feel the soles of your feet on the floor, just really feeling them. Okay, becoming aware of yourself sitting on the chair, feeling the chair beneath you, letting the chair take your full weight. Okay. Really and becoming aware of the space around you. The people around you. So you might be actually experiencing now some kind of, this is kind of slightly different in terms of your state of mind, and maybe allowing the mind really to sort of settle gradually. If we're going to take this a little bit further, you might tune into your breathing. And again, come back to the soles of your feet. I'd offer that as a little micro technique. If you have your attention in the soles of your feet, it's very difficult to be in your head. If your head's a real mess, it's actually quite a nice thing to do, is just bring your attention to the soles of your feet. Feel your feet on the ground, feeling grounded. Some people say, my feet didn't touch the ground all day, so let your feet touch the ground. So listening in a state like this is going to be far more deep. And the final habit is authentic appreciation. So we're going to practice this in a little bit. Authentic appreciation, I'd just like to name check Rick Hansen, the neuroscientist, who has written a book called Hardwired for Happiness. And he talks about how we are, a lot of people might have heard of him, how we are, we're Teflon for joy and we're Velcro for suffering. So we kind of remember the difficult stuff. We remember the slights and the hurts and things like that. And we forget the sort of appreciation. And it's an evolutionary thing, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about in a minute. But we're evolved to scan the horizon for difficulty in the future, and we're evolved to remember the difficult things in the past. That's why we're Velcro for suffering, because we need to remember where it was in order to avoid it again. But this happens on an emotional as well as a kind of a physical level. So authentic appreciation actually starts reversing some of that. So actually really appreciating somebody. They're saying in a relationship, there's a couple of pieces of research in business and in couple relationships, that if you have a ratio of appreciation to criticism of roughly 5 to 1, that's the optimum ratio for a relationship to flourish. I wonder if anybody thinks they're getting anywhere near that in terms of their work relationships. Okay, so what I'm going to invite you to do is just get into pairs. So just turn your chair towards the person who's or sit next to each other. Okay. If there's an odd number, then they're going to. Somebody's going to draw the short straw and have me to talk to. Okay, is everybody in a pair? No, you need pairs. Is there any other sort of solo? But you definitely need a pair. Has everybody got a pair? Okay. So what I'd like you to do is get ready to listen. Okay, one person you need to negotiate. Who's going to actually be the person just thinking? Who's going to do the listening? Okay, just decide that amongst yourselves. Can you just decide that now? Okay. All done. You need to move. Good. Okay. So you've decided who's going. The people who are about to listen, just think a little bit about that kind of quiet mind stuff, and maybe actually feet on the ground, quieten your mind, and get ready to listen. Get ready to listen with delight, I've heard it referred to. Listen with delight, okay? So, the instruction is really, really simple, but it's really important you stick to it, which is that people who are listening say nothing, okay? Lots of non-verbals is fine, but no kind, it's not a chat, okay? You are going to listen. It's only going to be 2 minutes, okay? You're going to listen, okay? Don't say anything. Unless the person dries up, you might be able to say, and what else? Okay. In response to this question. So find out your partner's name, say your partner's name, and say, Harold, whatever your name, what can you do to take better care of yourself? And then you say nothing, and the other person will think out loud in our response to that question. 2 minutes, okay? So are you ready? Go.
I'll do it with my daughter when I get home.
Okay, I'm sorry to bring it to an end. That's your go. We don't need to. It shows how much you can get in 2 minutes, doesn't it? Okay, so, other person's turn now. Do exactly the same thing, your partner's name. What can you do to take better care of yourself?
It might be on the, I think that's going to send it out.
Okay, that's wonderful. Now, stay in your pairs. We're now going to do some authentic appreciation. Now, this goes really quite against the grain for a lot of us because we're quite good at dodging appreciation. It's like, no, it's not me. What I want you to do, okay, is I want you to, again, say your partner's name, and whatever you've appreciated about them, or you probably have just met your partner, whatever you've appreciated about them, it could be something really minor, such as I just really appreciate the fact that you're here, or something like that, okay? So your partner's name, what I appreciate about you is, and then say that, say it from the heart, say you mean it, it needs to be authentic, it's not got to be, you know, so, and therefore it needs to be something which you really genuinely appreciate. So each have a go at saying that, your partner's name, what I appreciate about you is, okay, go. Appreciation, just come back into the kind of semicircle. There's a lot of appreciation. Okay, thank you. This is really great. Maybe I should just go.
I appreciate you too.
Okay. I'm going to have to really, really rattle through the next bit, and so I kind of apologise for this. I think one of the great difficulties about a lot of this is that so much. Of the ways in which we relate to ourselves and others are so deeply ingrained that we actually need a lot of work to kind of shift them. So I want to offer you three ideas, and we're going to do a little bit more practice as well, three ideas that might actually shift those. And it is going to be a rattle through. And if it doesn't work for you, then just forget it and just let it go, okay? Hopefully I'm not going to be too confusing about this. Now, Margaret Thatcher famously said, there is no such thing as society. Does everybody kind of remember that? It's kind of, you know, emblazoned on your brain, you know. Okay, well, from a relational viewpoint, there is no such thing as an individual. Okay? No such thing as an individual. And there's some references here. Physically, the ecological self, okay, Arne Nice, Stephen Harding, fantastic Radio 4 30-minute programme, which is there to listen to, that we are so interconnected with our planet that it is actually impossible to actually say that we are separate from it. Okay. Only one in every 10 of our cells is actually human, the rest are microbial. We are so interconnected that to actually think of ourselves as separate is just ridiculous, really, from a physical point of view. Psychologically, we interact, therefore I become something from a very, very young age. That there is not a me that starts off. Actually, I am purely a relational being that is formed out of my relationships with others. Okay. And logically, philosophically, which is probably the more difficult one, the impossibility of separateness. And I was going to go into a bit of a logical thing about Chandrakirti, but I won't do that. Does anybody want to hear about Chandrakirti? Yeah? Okay. I don't take much persuasion. Okay. Chandrakirti, 7th century Indian magician, okay, talked about looking, analysing a chariot to find the essence of a chariot, okay? Because we actually see things, we think, well, that's just a glass, or this is a person here, you know. This is a Volkswagen Golf Mark II, circa 1980. So you can say, where's the car? You go, there's the car. And then you say, where's the car? And then you say, where's the car? Okay? This idea that an individual is just a label for a temporary and ever-changing set of specific relations. This is quite kind of profound philosophy, but these are the sorts of ideas we need to shift, this sort of idea that I am here separate and you are there separate, and I'm a thing that cannot change. We think, you know, I am, like, you know, your question, are some people just, you know, can you teach compassion? Yes, you can, because we are fundamentally relational beings. Things are not first self-contained entities and then interact. Each thing, including each person, is first and always a nexus of relations. Okay? Which means that it's fundamentally workable, which means I can change. So if I'm not compassionate, I can work at it and work at intelligently relating to myself and change that.
Can I just spell capital words with you?
Sorry?
Capital words
with you. Yes. You're right. Chandrakirti. He's a very great Indian logician. The other idea is everyone is always doing their absolute best to be happy. That includes, and I don't want to be flippant about this, but that includes people who really do very, very bad things. Okay, we very often characterise and caricature people as villains. George Osborne, David Cameron. You know. Easy, you know. I saw a thing on the internet the other day with next to the fantastic picture where they caught them looking exactly like the Cray twins, you know. And you know, it's really, you know, really fun. But actually, they are human beings, and they are doing their absolute best to be happy. They're just not doing it very well, okay? Because they don't understand the fundamental relatedness of themselves and others. I don't think. I don't know whether I do, really. I'm not standing here claiming that I'm a kind of a, that I'm better than anybody. But it is about relational intelligence, okay? Now, in health and social service, I'm going to bring this down to kind of where you work. I'm aware of the time. This is from Paul Gilbert. And he talks about three types of affect regulation system, where if they're in balance, it's all good. We need our threat system. We need to actually be able to, and this is something that comes from evolution, we needed to be, when we were on the planes, we needed to be on the lookout for danger. We needed to be able to do the fight-flight stuff, okay? Modern day, we need to know that crossing the, you know, a motorway is going to be dangerous. You need that threat system. The do system, the incentive resource focus, wanting, pursuing, achieving, assuming, doing stuff. You know, we are the tool makers. Humans are tool makers. We do stuff, we build stuff. We need that.
But we also read safeness, soothing,
which is why I come back to that sort of the idea of this kind of circle, sitting in a circle, being with each other, supporting each other, accessing kindness, accessing affiliation, safety, soothing from each other. And when they're in balance, it's all great. But in the health and social care system, you could talk about permanent white water, increasing expectations, more for less, and from government, that is, and then increasing expectations, I think, from patients, where there's sort of access, convenience, safety, dignity, compassion. So there's the sort of, the system is saying, be, treat people like things, and people are saying, don't treat us like things. I put a broken system. Is the system broken? I don't know. Or is it just really functioning very, very badly? But what that means is that this is how people feel. Massively unfair, with massive stuff to do, and our safety system is kind of virtually non-existent. So we're way out of balance. What can we do? How do we find ways to bring that balance back? Okay. This is going to sound ridiculous, like a truism. Humans function best when we're feeling loving, when we're feeling caring, when we're feeling loved and valued, rather than unloved and unvalued. And the dangers of disconnection, this comes from this kind of idea of, you know, the fundamentally relatedness, that self to self. If we don't look after ourselves, if we start cutting bits off of ourselves, you know, not looking after our physical health, or not looking after specific aspects of our physical health, not looking after our emotional health, then these things are going to they're going to impact on us quite dramatically if you keep doing that. But it's more easier to see the self to other if there's a sort of a capitalist society, a competitive society. When you start actually kind of mistreating people, excluding people, it's hugely injurious. And when you see this from a relational viewpoint, when you see that actually if we're all fundamentally related, it's like if I was to tie a tourniquet around my hand as a way of cutting off the blood supply, my hand would eventually drop off in a very, very kind of painful way. And that's the way to kind of think about ourselves and the way we are, I suppose, emotionally, thinking about how we cut parts of ourselves off, but also in a sense of a societal way, marginalised, excluded, and isolated. And that's what this conference is all about how people, how incredibly injurious it is to health, mental, physical and mental well-being. Does that all make sense?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the third idea. So if compassion is at the heart of health and social care, and I think most people would agree that it is, that compassion is not something that is layered on top, it's not something that kind of, you know, compassion is the thing that brings people into healthcare. Compassion is arguably the thing that actually gave rise to our health and social care system, an altruistic wish. Which is absolutely amazing when you think about it. Self-compassion is at the heart of compassion. Okay. It's an idea to think about. It's the first aid principle. If you're a first aider and you're in an accident with many other people, the first thing you do is you, am I okay? Look after yourself before you go and help others. You're on an airplane and it starts going down, the oxygen mask come down, they say, attend to your own before you attend to your precious child's. You know, it's that kind of, again, relational intelligence. This is not about being self-indulgent, this is about a very practical approach to actually how do I remain able to be compassionate to others. You start with yourself. So this is Chris Germer. I think that it kind of sometimes makes people take a shot and take a breath. The experience of compassion is complete abandonment of the inclination to resist emotional discomfort. The full acceptance of the personal pain and of our own reactions to the pain. And self-compassion is just giving that same kindness to yourself. Okay. So I'm going to invite you, to do a bit of self-compassion. We're going to do something called a self-compassion break. If you don't want to do it, that's absolutely fine. Just sit there and think about your holiday or tune me out. So I want you to come again into a kind of a... feet on the floor, again. I'll walk you through it first. The three parts of a self-compassion break. The first thing we do is we acknowledge the difficulty. And I think that's very often one of the most difficult things is to actually, I think when you're in a very, very busy environment, is to notice your own need, okay, or notice your own distress or something like that. So the first thing is about acknowledging your own need, acknowledging the impact of an event. And I'm going to ask you to think about the event in maybe the recent past or the deep and distant past. Nothing traumatic, okay? It's got to be something that caused you some distress, but nothing that's really kind of poleaxed you or really did you in, okay? Something which was challenging for you and caused you some kind of emotional difficulty. So acknowledge it. And then we realize that our response doesn't set us apart from others, doesn't isolate us as a human race. Actually, the reason we feel like this is because we're human. And it means that we're not alone in that feeling. Okay? And then the third step is actually giving yourself some kindness in the same way as you would give to a dear friend. If you've never done this before, it can seem really kind of alien. So it does require some practice, and this is just an introduction to it. The key thing in this is actually self-talk, okay? So when we're doing the acknowledging, when we're doing the realizing we're not alone, and when we're actually doing the kindness, is you find phrases which you repeat to yourself. And this is really important. This is part of the relational intelligence. This is relating to yourself in that way, okay? And you're using language to do it. Okay, so if you don't want to do it, as I said, please just, you know, tune me out. So just coming into a kind of a nice comfortable position, upright if you can, feeling your feet on the floor again, bringing your attention to the soles of your feet. And tuning into your breathing. And just allowing a kind of a settling and relaxing. If you feel any kind of stress or strain in your body, just allowing that to dissipate if you can. You can shut your eyes if you like, or have your eyes in a sort of a soft focus gaze, just sort of about 45 degree angle if you prefer to keep your eyes open. I'm going to be inviting you to actually experiment with some compassionate touch if you would like to do it, where you actually put a hand maybe over your heart or something like that, if you would like to do that. Some people find that really just a step too far. But it's going to be very powerful, and there's some good research to show that it can be impactful. But that's the final stage of giving ourselves some time. So, just bringing to mind this event that recently has caused you some difficulty. As I say, nothing traumatic, but just something where you experienced some kind of emotional upset. Maybe you were sad or angry, maybe jealous, or something that caused a difficult emotional response. So when you've got the event, then really tune into it. Really remember how it felt. Remembering what was said. Remembering what happened. And if this happens, it doesn't always happen, but if you become aware of where you feel it in your body, then kind of, you know, bring some attention to that. You feel some, I don't know, tightening on the shoulders or some hollowness in the stomach. Any physical response, just being aware of that. Fully acknowledging that. So in your own words, acknowledge this. Acknowledge the difficulty. It could be something like, that was really difficult for me. Or, I'm so upset. It's got to be your words. Acknowledging that to yourself. That was so difficult for me. now the recognition that your response doesn't set you apart from the human race, it connects you. Those feelings that you're experiencing at this very moment, there'll be millions of people across the world feeling almost exactly the same feeling. It's a human thing to experience. So recognizing that you're not alone in this. And again, finding your own words. Everybody struggles. Anybody would have felt that in those circumstances. I know I'm not alone in this. Now, if you'd like to experiment with the compassionate touch, maybe place your hand on your heart or maybe on your shoulder. Just giving yourself some kindness. Really, sort of warmth and kindness that you would feel for a dear friend who is going through this. Just directing that at yourself. And again, accompanying it with your own words. Whatever they may be, like, it's okay, I know this will pass. I'll be fine, I'll be able to look after myself. It's okay. Something that gives voice to that kindness that you're offering yourself. If you're using the compassionate touch, really feeling the warmth from your hand. Kind touch. I'll get through this. It'll be okay. It will pass. Okay. Just now, letting that visualization dissolve. Coming back to the soles of your feet and your body, sitting on the chair. Your eyes shut. You can open your eyes. Come back to the room. So, it's called a self-compassion break. I don't know if everybody's going to get the slides. Are they going to get the slides from this? Great, okay. Because there's the selfcompassion.org, which is Kristin Neff's website. Kristin Neff was one of the formulators of mindful self-compassion, which is now currently being taught by the Center for Mindfulness Research and Practice. It's really great. I would really recommend it to everyone. I've been a long-term Buddhist. Sounds like a health condition. And I for 25, 30 years, I've been practicing kind of meditation, compassion meditation, that sort of thing. Mindful self-compassion connected something up for me. It was really quite amazing. It's something which I think that is dearly, seriously lacking in our society is a sense of kindness towards ourselves. It did feel like something had been disconnected, and it connected something up. It was like, wow, look at this. It really did, and it really opened my heart up. So I'd really recommend it. Although it's not for everyone, so it's okay if you don't kind of get it. There are the steps, but as I say, it's all free to access on the self-compassion website. There's lots of other meditations on that website as well. So, what are we going to do now? I can't remember. Yes, this is the kind of just a pictorial thing that looking after yourself allows you to be more compassionate to others, compassionate communities, compassionate organizations, compassionate communities. That's the ideal, but I really do believe this most strongly. It really feels really logical to me that if you don't look after yourself, if you don't have that kindness to yourself, it's very easy to become quickly exhausted when we're trying to offer it to others, when we're trying to remain available to others. Does that really make sense to people?
Children, she said, when you do your ironing,
yeah. The kids' uniforms on.
Yeah.
She said, because when you've done everybody else's, it's you, you're thinking, oh, I just want to go to bed, have a cup of tea. I said, when you get up in the morning, the kids are really smart and you're standing in stuck clothes. You look in the mirror and you go, oh, God, I look awful, and then you feel awful. And you're out the door and you think people are looking at you because I'm a bit scruff.
Yeah.
She said, well, do you first. I said, then you feel fantastic. She said, then when you meet the kids, you'll say, wow.
Yeah.
And she said, you'd be feeling good yourself, so you have to, you're sorted.
I just think that's wonderful. That is so. That's such a wonderful. Did you get to hear that?
I heard it. It makes total sense. I was going to say this to Wendy earlier on. She did, when you spoke about getting some of the people in the hospital, their hospice, to actually care for each other, it's far, far easier. And this happens all the people, every homeless group I've ever met. They look after each other better than they look after themselves.
Yep.
It's always, if you want somebody to be an appointment, tell their friend. Their friend will get them to that point where he won't or she won't.
And this is really important, because we need to trick ourselves a little bit, because it does feel odd being kind to yourself. Some of the things that Kristen Neff suggests saying to yourself, like, it's all right, darling, that sort of thing. I can't say that. I can't, you know. It's just not me, you know, so it needs to be your own words. But the thing that really resonates for me is treat yourself like you would a good friend. And that is the key to actually angling that warmth which you give out to others and actually give it to yourself. And I think I love these kind of micro things that you can do in your daily life. Doing little things like that that you know are gonna work are just so important. This is a kind of a practice and a way of being, okay? This is not a kind of a one-off solution, attending a course and that's it and you're done. This is actually about changing the way you relate to yourself, which will change the way you relate to others. I'm aware of the time, and I really I wanted to do a little bit of dialogue, but I don't think it's going to work. So I wonder if we can just do a little bit more couple work, pair work, because that seemed to work quite well. Bone dialogue is something, I was going to take it a step further and say, how you work in your teams by giving safe spaces for people, and this is probably asking a bit because everybody is so pushed for time, so time poor, but if you can have a safe space where people can just share with each other how they are thinking and feeling about situations in a bone dialogue way, which is actually, it's a very open way of thinking and being with each other. Very similar to the sorts of things we were practicing in the pairs, where you listen with respect, okay? In David Bohm's idea, it was that actually if you suspend your own judgment, and if you have kind of a completely agendaless space, then something different emerges. But I don't think we've got the time or the space to do that, really. I don't know.
Also true when you're meeting a patient for the first time. If you get free narrative, you can get all the information you need without going through a tick list.
Yes, absolutely. So what I'm thinking of doing is actually going into pairs, doing some thinking and listening together, and then coming back into the semicircle again. It'd be nice if it was a circle, and just maybe sharing some things if you would like to do that as a way of kind of finishing off. How does that sound? Should we do that? Okay. So into your pairs, and we're going to ask another question that matters. Okay. So thinking about all the things that you've kind of listened to so far, thinking about compassion is, I think, if you want to think about compassion as a relationally intelligent thing to do. 2 minutes, thinking and listening.
Is this self-compassion?
Hey?
I'm self-compassion.
It can be whatever. It can be whatever. Really, it's an open kind of thinking. What can be done to embed compassion in our team organisations? 2 minutes each. Go. Partner's name. Thank you.
Okay, so now it's the other person's turn. Partner's name. What could be done to embed compassion in our team or organisation? Yeah? What could be done to embed compassion in our team or organisation? Partner's name. Do you want me to put it up again? Remember, it's just listening, okay? No speaking. One person talking, the other person listening. Okay, that's great. Wonderful. I think, as I said, you probably had very little chance to sort of talk really apart from the brain. Can we just come together? I'd really just like us maybe to have some sort of exchange of ideas and, you know, for me to kind of not sit at the front and maybe just for people to sort of maybe share some of their ideas, maybe that come out of that or anywhere else, if they would like to.
I very much see power as one of the main obstacles to compassion.
Yes.
Because I think it offers people the illusion that they can make people do what they want them to do. And I think that's got overt and covert consequences.
Yeah.
So I'm a great believer.
Yes, that's wonderful. Thank you.
I find working in a team is an art, and I always find in understanding myself is challenging, quite challenging. So, and understanding others is all the more challenging. And particularly when you have people in a team with the different characters, some could be ambitious, some could be of various traits, you know. What can you do? Sometimes you feel helpless.
Yes.
As a person, what can you do to bring it together?
Yeah.
So the practical approach I follow is kind of understanding, show them understanding as much as possible.
Yes.
And show a little lack of kindness.
Yes. Stop. Yeah.
I'm a peer support worker that works in the NHS, and I'm really passionate about certainly the self-compassion bit. I've spent years trying to figure out how to better take care of myself and kind of finally realized that that was something I needed to prioritize. And working in the NHS, I kind of noticed that other colleagues, they do a super stressful job, but they weren't prioritizing their own needs first. And I think me being in there and really enjoying the job, but also really prioritizing my need to make sure that I'm looking after myself, has struck a chord with a few of my colleagues, hopefully a lot of them. And my manager actually very kindly agreed for me to bring in a colleague of yours from the Centre for Resilience to do 4 1-hour sessions, doing a little bit of mindful self-compassion, just because I think she saw the passion that I had for it and could knew that we needed it.
It could be such value in the NHS, couldn't it? Because very fact we've all chosen to come into this session shows you that we understand this, but aren't here.
Yes.
And I've often thought, or occasionally thought, why are you in this job when you've got no compassion, you know, about colleagues? Thankfully, not many. But as you said, it's maybe that they've had it because they haven't taken care of themselves. It's drained away over the years. Yeah.
I don't think anyone intentionally goes into work to not care.
No.
In a caring environment, but I think we become brutalized.
Yeah.
I sort of sat with a condition I've had to for years. I've been in psychiatry for 30 odd years, but I've moved away and moved into another area, another building, and I've recently gone back. And going upstairs to the teams, and there's a real change there, and that it seems dark, subdued, and powerless. There's a powerlessness there.
You can feel like that,
and you know, this thing about, you know,
yes.
You know, one of the things I'm going to take back is that, you know, psychologically, those informed environments that we should have those in the workplace. And it's great that hospitals are doing them now, and I'm involved with that with some of our hospitals. But, you know, just sort of thinking, actually, my colleagues upstairs are, you know, we're not looking at them, we're not looking at, because if they fall and they found a bit like the army, then they're not going to go out
and give
their
50 people
on their
case. That is so true. Yeah.
It's worth thinking about. In the NHS there are resources to put on, so I'm a GP from Beaver Street in Oxford. We're actually run by Oxford Health and NHS Trust, and we didn't realise there's a head of spiritual and pastoral care.
Oh.
We're now getting him down once, roughly every 6 weeks, and he's a space for our team to sort of discuss any difficult patient cases, any difficult issues in the team, you know, just that space to actually acknowledge that we're doing really difficult jobs.
Yeah.
And it's just, as you say, there's people that don't want to do it, and interestingly, they're the people that are now getting engaged and discussing things. So it's a really good, you've got to pull on what resources you can have.
Yes.
I just really quickly want to say that we can teach people or help people, support people in learning how to take care of themselves. We aren't doing that for ourselves.
Absolutely.
And that.
Got to walk the talk.
You
really do. You really have to. This is so important. And it's something about being Mahatma Gandhi. Be the change you want to see in the world. I think again, there's something about that. I just want to refer to what you were saying because I think that matches with the slide, the last slides I've got, which is the ego system, which the hierarchy of the kind of power is dominant, and sort of the individual is, and you know, individual behaviour kind of gets crushed. People's individual sense of agency. And so the sort of sense of solidarity, sort of shared knowledge is dissipated. And people, teams fracture. I've seen this myself. You go in, when people are under a lot of stress, they tend to go into themselves rather than come together.
Because I didn't feel any joy or laughter and intense smile.
Yeah.
People's heads on the desk.
People are frightened. People are frightened. They're in fear. They're in the threat system, you know, in their amygdala, in their fight-flight response, rather than actually engaging the parts. I did. Thank you. It's impressive because what I do want to say is.
I shook my head and
just have to laugh. No, thank you. Thank you so much because, and this is really important, that this idea of relationality doesn't mean there's no individuality. And actually, from a relational viewpoint, if people are fundamentally connected, it means we can be really different because there's
no danger of separation. It's only when we think we're separate that we think, oh, we can't be too different, we need to be together. You know, there's that kind of fear. So actually, this idea of being actually that there's no essential individuality allows for much more difference. Does that make sense?
It's a really important point. That what I was sort of trying to say is actually that the unit that to think about actually is, Thatcher said, no such thing as society. That's a much more relationally intelligent unit to think about. If you're going to say there is a thing, to say that, but not to say there's no such thing as individuality. It's not saying there's no such thing as an ability to be different. It's just recognizing that we're fundamentally connected in such a way that to separate us is damaging. That's what I'm saying.
Is that a phrase I've used lots and lots of times? It's you're a one-off, you're totally original and completely unique, just like everyone else.
Wonderful. So just the opposite of the ego system is the ecosystem, where the individual behaviour is kind of where it starts from. Be the change you want to see. Share knowledge. And then sort of the hierarchy and the solidarity are kind of in their right places. I changed, this is from Matthew Taylor from the RSA, I changed it to talk about dialogue, which is what we do with ourselves, self to self, self to other, brings about shared knowledge, brings about that greater recognition of what the need is, and within teams, a sort of a shared knowledge and a culture of kind of care and compassion, which builds trust in a structural way. But if there's one thing I want to leave you with, it's that pause, that coming into the soles of your feet, and to breathe, and to be kind to yourself. If there's one thing I'd really like you to take away is that. Pause, breathe, and a kind presence.